You're listening to the WFYI Weekly News Podcast for the week of Monday, January 18th, 2016. I'm Christopher Ayers. Syringe exchanges have been shown to reduce the spread of disease through needle sharing, but there are few in rural areas. But a federal spending bill could mean help is on the way.
A lot of the impact is going to be in more rural and suburban areas.
Then, three professional educators, a father and his two daughters, have written a book aimed at keeping young teachers in the classroom.
Our number one goal is we want our school to become more like the new teacher, not for the new teacher to become like the school.
And the story of a small Indiana city that almost lost control of its water utility and what the state is doing to help other communities avoid that fate. Those stories are coming up. Please stay tuned. First this week, you probably use between 80 and 100 gallons of water every day. But when you flush the toilet or turn on the faucet, it's nothing you even think twice about. It's so simple for us as consumers, but for the utilities and those working on the back end, it's not always easy. You can travel across the state and see the struggles local communities are facing to keep their water plants up to federal regulations. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Joe Wren traveled to one small Indiana city that almost lost control of its utility, and he explains what the state is doing to help other cities facing the same potential fate.
The 2010 census showed Greencastle is growing. For the first time, the population topped 10,000 people. But the new number meant the city was also now subject to new regulations for a precious resource, water.
I really don't know if there's something to lose sleep over at night. I mean, that's it.
Sue Murray's last day as Greencastle mayor became the deadline for the city to comply with state orders to upgrade its water treatment plant. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management classified Greencastle as a large water producer under the influence of surface water in October of 2013. Greencastle Utility Superintendent Robert Lovell says the agency gave Greencastle a deadline of December 31st to comply with new regulations.
They consider groundwater basically pre-filtered. So if your well is too close to that water source, you can basically pull in that influence.
Greencastle's water wells are located along Big Walnut Creek. That's a concern to Indiana Department of Environmental Management Drinking Water Branch Chief Mary Hollingsworth, since the wells could be pumping water from the creek, making it susceptible to viruses and other contaminants.
There's a new groundwater rule that says that you have to sample your wells directly and not through the distribution system like they normally do. When they sample the wells directly, one of their wells got a positive for E. coli.
The city had to raise water rates to pay for more than $2.5 million in plant upgrades, including building a million-gallon tank so they don't have to staff the plant 24 hours a day. But Lovell says they can't run the plant without at least four certified operators.
You have to be able to pass a pretty rigorous test that the state gives out, and at this time, they only give it out twice a year.
If you don't pass the test Lovell describes as rigorous, you don't get certified as an operator. Hollingsworth agrees the test is difficult.
But you don't want to make it easy because these people are in charge of people's drinking water.
Lovell was one of the few who passed it the first time. After taking it once, twice, three times, many other staff members still hadn't passed it. Murray says the city's utility conducted a national search for certified operators. The results were disappointing. No qualified applicants.
I wrote to the commissioner and I said, what are we going to do? He said, well, we're working on changing the test. And maybe by the first of the year, I said, it doesn't help me.
She was facing the realization that the city might have to sell its water facility. It's happening in cities across the state. Indiana American Water provides service to more than 50 communities in Indiana, including Terre Haute and Kokomo, to name a few. The company is able to absorb the costs and resources of operating a high-level water plant easier than a small city would. Kokomo Mayor Greg Goodnight says he's happy with the service Indiana American Water provides, but at times wishes the city had more control.
We ran the water company. There may be areas where we would extend lines to.
Hollingsworth says there is a sense of pride lost when cities privatize a service.
That's my town. Those are my folks. Those are my town people. But I've known a lot of little towns that went with bigger corporations.
Privatization often means losing control of water rates, plant jobs, and response time. Lovell breathed a sigh of relief when, after four tries, the city's utility operators did pass the test, and the city met all of its deadlines to be able to continue to operate the plant.
Local individuals who have been working for the utility for many, many years, some of them up to 38 years, who've ingrained, they have a good heart, and they care about their community because they live here.
But still, there could be a new problem on the horizon. Certified operators are in high demand.
They're picked up by people that the bigger companies.
The state has commissioned Ivy Tech to revise the operator tests, and Hollingsworth says beginning in February, they'll administer them monthly. Anderson and Carmel are other cities under review for being under the influence of surface water. For Indiana Public Broadcasting in Greencastle, I'm Joe Wren.
Injection drug abuse and rates of hepatitis C are on the rise in rural America. But syringe exchange programs, which have been shown to reduce the spread of disease, are located mostly in cities. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only 1 in 5 exchanges are found in rural areas. But as Jake Harper of Side Effect Public Media reports, a bill passed by Congress late last year could change that.
The needle exchange in Fayette County, Indiana, is hidden in a back office at the health department. Paula Maupin runs the exchange. Basically, it's a desk with baskets of everything a drug user needs, apart from the drugs. Syringes, cotton balls, alcohol swabs, even tourniquets.
I struggle with that. I would much rather talk them into going to rehab as opposed to having to do all this, but I know that's not going to happen, so I do it.
Maupin has seen what sharing supplies can lead to. Last year, another rural Indiana county got hit with an outbreak of HIV. The number of cases in Scott County, where drug abuse is rampant, has topped 180. Fayette County had its own addiction problem, and its rate of hepatitis C was similar to Scott County's.
So that kind of scared us, and we got contacted by the state, and they recommended that we seriously consider applying for a needle exchange. So that's what we did.
But then they hit a barrier. The county couldn't pay for it. Maupin was able to eventually land a small grant, which helped her purchase the supplies she has now. But once business picks up at the exchange, those supplies will not last long.
Don't know what we're going to do. There won't be any money. So I just pray. Do a lot of praying.
Change could be on the way. Last month, President Obama signed the Omnibus Spending Bill. The bill includes language to lift restrictions on using federal funds for needle exchanges. Money still can't be used to purchase needles themselves, but can help pay for staff and other supplies. Daniel Raymond of the Harm Reduction Coalition says this is good news for counties like Fayette.
I'm expecting that a lot of the impact is going to be in more rural and suburban areas that don't have a whole lot of resources but do have some access to federal funds.
After paying for things like roads and schools and jails, rural counties don't usually have a lot of leftover money for something like a needle exchange, but federal dollars could help.
There are several communities across the country who haven't done this but want to do this and are really looking into it. So Ohio, West Virginia, you know, Oregon, et cetera.
Beth Meyerson heads the Rural Center for AIDS and STD Prevention. She says the change is a good first step. The problem is some states don't take in a lot of federal funds for public health. For instance, in 2014, Indiana was dead last in how much money it took from the CDC on a per capita basis. And even if a state applies for funding, it's not guaranteed to go to rural places.
We'll want to watch, does it hit the ground, and does it hit the ground in every community that really needs it? Or is it hitting the ground in only metro communities?
Another issue is that a lot of states still don't even allow needle exchanges. Raymond says a number of states are looking to change that this year. And at the federal level, he says there needs to be more money made available for problems stemming from addiction.
So that's going to be a big issue in 2016. Can Congress and the administration come up with more dollars to deal with harm reduction, syringe exchange, to deal with overdose, to deal with drug treatment, to deal with the whole spectrum of issues that Indiana and so many other states around the country are confronting right now?
Back in Fayette County, Paula Maupin worries about people contracting hepatitis C or HIV. The possibility of running out of supplies for the needle exchange, it weighs on her.
I have had so many sleepless nights, waking up in a panic, wondering how on earth I'm going to make this happen.
More money would be a big relief. Jake Harper, Side Effects Public Media.
Side Effects Public Media is a health reporting partnership based at WFYI in Indianapolis. Finally this week, teacher retention is a growing problem in Indiana. Reports show that about half of the state's new teachers leave the profession within the first 5 years. In this latest installment of her first year series, State Impact Indiana's Claire McInerney talks with a family, a father and two daughters, who wrote a book coming out this spring to help new teachers make it through.
Good morning, ma'am. Hold on, bud. It's good to see you, sir. Ian, this morning.
Madeline Whitaker stands outside her third grade classroom. She stops each student as they approach and greets them and gives them instructions.
Good to see you, bud. Come on in.
This is her second year in the classroom, and this hasn't always been part of her morning routine.
There's one bus group where like five boys come in, and so that's the reason why I do this, is to make sure no issues come off the bus, or since issues happen on the bus, make sure it doesn't enter the classroom.
This is one of many tactics Madeline and her sister Catherine Whitaker have developed over the last 4 years. Research shows the first 5 years in the classroom are critical for teacher retention because most new teachers quit before their fifth year. Catherine is in the middle of her fourth school year and says getting support from a principal is key for new teachers.
And I feel like we don't talk about how you're not going to be perfect. There are going to be mistakes. You are going to mess up. And if a principal could be that sounding board and say, you're going to mess up. There's going to be a day that goes terrible. Please feel free to come to me.
This is the angle of their new book. And they wrote it with their father, Todd Whitaker, who is also a professor of educational leadership at Indiana State, a principal's teacher. The book reflects Todd's philosophy on hiring new teachers.
Think about the enthusiasm level of a new teacher. Typically, it's sky high. You know, my belief system is we need to, when we hire a new teacher, our number one goal is we want our school to become more like the new teacher, not for the new teacher to become like the school.
The Whitakers write that principals need to frequent their new teachers' classrooms during the first few months of a school year. And Madeline says it doesn't have to be time-consuming.
Yes, but it is truly as simple as pop into their classroom, see something that's going well, leave them a sticky note on their desk. The first-year teacher will literally never forget that.
Because, she says, if the new teacher feels the principal is available and wants them to succeed, they'll be more willing to go to that principal for advice when they have a problem. If they don't view their principal as an ally, they might just try to figure it out on their own. And that feeling of drowning and uncertainty is what can drive new teachers away.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
Madeline and Catherine grew up in Indiana, but their first teaching positions happened to be in Missouri. I asked them if it feels strange to write a book about surviving the first 5 years when neither of them have made it to that five-year mark. This is Madeline in year two.
I think any first-year teacher is an expert about the first year of teaching.
I agree.
And we're just the ones who have a chance to work with an educational expert and put all our ideas together, our real-life ideas of being in the trenches, being in the classrooms, but then also our dad's overarching ideas about teaching and leadership.
Though they teach far away from their dad, the sisters say his philosophies still influence them. And these are in the book. But Madeline and Catherine also wrote about what they learned on their own. Catherine says learning to ask for help was one of her biggest lessons.
And so I just got to the point where things were just breaking. And I was very dead set on, I'll figure it out. I'll figure it out on my own. I don't need to ask for help. I was embarrassed. I wanted to be this exceptional, magical teacher, and I wasn't. And that's crushing to somebody who's so passionate about education.
Her principal helped her recognize that not everything was broken and helped her develop a plan to get the kids academically and behaviorally back on track.
It just like changed everything. He made me feel empowered. And him forcing himself into my life when I wasn't going to let him into my life changed everything.
Madeline also found moments where she forced herself out of her comfort zone, and it's led to her growth as an educator. Because she has support, she feels comfortable being creative with her classroom routines, like playing a song the kids like while they move from one subject to the other. The Whitakers' book is called Your First Year, How to Survive and Thrive as a New Teacher. Everything the sisters learned about finding support got Catherine to the almost five-year point and Madeline to enroll in a master's in education administration. For State Impact Indiana, I'm Claire McInerney.
To read and listen to more stories from Claire's first year series, as well as State Impact's reporting on education issues around the state, go to stateimpactindiana.org. That's it for this edition of the WFYI Weekly News Podcast. You can follow us online at WFYI.org, on Twitter at WFYI News, and on Facebook, WFYI. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. You can stream it on the web at SoundCloud. Just search WFYI. This has been a production of WFYI News, produced at 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Studios in Indianapolis. I'm Christopher Ayers. Thanks for listening.